telephone company brings you the correct time. 2:15:40.
But it's like dreams, you know, your dream is all mixed up. It's here, it's there. Endless summer wells. I arrived in the small city as arranged and made my way to the house. I cut across the churchyard. I'd hated this place when I first saw it. Then I lived here and I loved it. And then I moved away. And I still loved it. And now I'm back. I loitered on the way to the house. My friends still lived there, Marilyn and Eric. I walked along a parallel street. I poked my head around the corner into the streets where I once lived and my friends now live. I approached the house. No answer.
4 o'clock.
No matter. I would explore some more and return later. This street curved around behind. You could almost mistake the two for one if you didn't know the way. I went around the curve at the back. Traffic lights.
Stop.
I had to wait to cross. It's unimportant whether I met my friends or not. The important thing was the spirit of the area. And the expectation of meeting them there.
The expectation of meeting them there.
They really were nice people. But I love the streets. And the churchyard, the open area of grass. It was almost like a dream being back here. Almost like a dream.
Almost like a dream.
But different. Better. I was really happy that day. End.
In one of your stories, The Golden Age, which I must have read well over a decade ago, a young student named Robert is being driven somewhere when he sees, in your words, a change in the form
of the street a little way ahead.
And then in the next panel, which is much larger, we see a huge golden Roman arch spanning the road. You draw this breathtaking scene, a sudden intrusion of the ancient into the mundane, with the rearview mirror visible in the upper frame. You can see Robert's dark silhouette in the lower corner, his mouth open in awe, just like the reader's. The arch has flags across the top, and it bristles with lights. And just beyond, you can actually see the normal world of street lamps and boxy buildings with water towers on them. And all of this is just to say that not long after reading this comic, I had a dream in which I was being driven home from work up the West Side Highway here in New York, and I turned to my left to see just such a structure, a vaulting, dazzlingly lit arch passing by. And it's one of the few dreams that I still carry around, and I feel like the blueprint is really from your comics. There's so much I want to ask you, but maybe this is a good place to start.
From KCRW and McSweeney's, this is The Organist, episode 100. I'm Andrew Leland. And the voice we're interrupting here is that of Ed Park. Ed was a founding editor of The Believer magazine, and he wrote the introduction to a new collection of comics by Chris Reynolds. Ed's also the author of the novel Personal Days, which is a book that anyone with an office job needs to read immediately. Like, go buy it and read it this afternoon. So on today's show, you'll hear more from Ed and his conversation with Chris Reynolds. They talk about Chris's new book, which is called The New World. And you'll also hear more stories from The New World. The producer, Angela Shackle, has taken the comic strips from the book and adapted them for radio. And these comics add up to a very strange sort of graphic novel. If you quickly flip through the book, you'll see a world that's real familiar to comics. The main character, who's named Monitor, wears a space helmet all the time, and he wanders around, encountering sometimes malevolent forces in the universe. But if you take a closer look and actually sit down to read The New World, you'll see that the book doesn't really have much to do with science fiction at all. It's got a very slow, meditative pace and a kind of ominous silence to it that makes it feel much closer to the aesthetics of experimental cinema, where Chris Reynolds got his start. In a lot of the comics collected in the book, almost nothing happens. Our space-helmeted hero will board a half-empty train or go to his job at a cafe, and that's it. But even as nothing happens, there's still somehow this sense of transcendent, ominous strangeness. It's really hard to explain how Reynolds pulls this off, these deep-feeling stories about nothing. But I think by the end of today's show, we're going to get there. The New World was edited and designed by the legendary cartoonist Seth, who's an accomplished writer and designer of graphic novels. And he's encyclopedic on the history of comics, which is another feature of today's episode. You're going to learn a lot about how comics work from people who've spent their whole lives thinking about that question.
My name is Seth. I go by a one-name pseudonym. I'm a cartoonist and a designer. Back in the 1980s, I worked at a small comics company in Toronto called Vortex Comics. And sometimes I would look through what they called the slush pile, which was unsolicited submissions people sent in. And I remember one day finding a two-page strip called The Lighted Cities in there by Chris Reynolds. I read it and I was impressed by it. What I liked about it was that it conveyed very little information about what was happening or the world it was in. And yet it was extremely evocative. You felt like there was a bigger, richer world that these two pages were connected to. It had that quality of a mystery about it, but it felt fully satisfying on its own too.
Seth kept running across Chris Reynolds' work. And over the span of a decade in many publications, he began to see how Reynolds was patiently building up this world, which Reynolds called Mauritania. Piece by piece, with each new comic, Reynolds developed his aesthetic, which follows the associative, imagistic logic of dreams. And this is where we'll pick up Ed Park's conversation with Chris Reynolds.
A lot of the work in the New World comics from Mauritania has this very dreamlike quality. And I wondered if I could ask, have you ever drawn material, whether it's images, characters, narration, dialogue, have you ever drawn it directly from your dreams?
I have, because Monitor's Human Reward, that is pretty well a dream, but it's a dream over two nights. I dreamt the first three quarters of it, and I thought, oh, that could be a story. And then I thought, but it hasn't got an end. But then the next night, I thought, oh, there's the end of it. And so I dreamt the rest of it. That's probably the most kind of literal transcription of a dream that I've ever done as a story. Monitor's Human Reward. After 2 weeks' work, Monitor still hated his new job. The customers made him wild. They came in every day to get on his nerves, and they smelled strongly. Monitor never let on, of course, and even received compliments for his service.
Going to bed was lovely, which made getting up in the morning even worse.
I think great source material, and, you know, dreams, they're all over the place. There's all sorts of things happening. But you can say, oh, an interesting theme there. I could use that bit, and then that bit, and then that bit. And, I've got a story. I'll draw it. This is how Monitor got his job at the cafe. A while ago, he'd been very bored because he hadn't done anything worthwhile in weeks. He'd come up the hill feeling very short of money.
It had been a funny day.
He'd been smiling a lot.
And had almost bullied the old lady behind the counter into taking him on as her assistant.
It's like a kind of lucid dream. You're sitting there and you're thinking, I'll move forward. And then you go forward.
He'd been in a weird mood all day.
And had even cleared out the sandwich cases and mended a couple of broken things.
The old lady had been very pleased.
But this morning, he'd received a letter. He'd read it once, then had come to work a little later even than usual. He sat down in the sun on the step of the house opposite the cafe. And then you go around a corner.
It was a short letter
that had arrived quite unexpectedly. It was about something he'd been left in a will. And what do you find round the corner? Oh, another corner. And then you go around that one. He'd been left this house.
Yes, this was definitely the right place. 17.
And then it kind of builds. He would be able to get in quite easily because he'd been sent the key and the letter. He sat quietly for a while, thinking about the house. He had some memories about it. He remembered some things quite clearly. He'd never actually been inside or even thought much about the house before, but he'd known the people that had lived there very slightly. The whole thing about having been left this house was a very strange situation. It wasn't even the people who'd lived there that had left him the house. It had been someone his parents had known once.
He really ought to go across and open up the cafe. He wished his friends were here.
Hello.
Hello.
They'd know what to do.
The comics have an obvious dreamlike quality to them. And I mean, we use the word dream for anything that it seems absurd, because I think there is a dream logic we all understand. For some reason, I guess we all kind of dream the same, which is that we combine narrative elements that don't make sense, and then we somehow accept them without questioning and allow the story to work. So when you read a comic like Chris's comics and you see that there are strange elements, there's an everyday world that seems normal. Monitor goes to work and works in a cafe, and then, you know, he receives a letter and he goes across the street or whatever. This all seems like regular, except that there are strange elements that don't quite fit. He's got a space helmet on for some reason. There's panels spent talking about what the light switches look like, or that the plants need watering. These are details that in an 8-page story, most cartoonists would say, I don't have any room for that. I've got to, you know, I've got a lot of stuff to get in here. I don't have time to talk about light switches. But that's the actual essential element that makes the work have that sort of both mundane and sort of dreamlike quality at the same time.
But this was the prettiest house in the terrace.
A mysterious world.
Monitor already had a clear idea of what it would look like inside. Sunny, but empty, with a tiny echo of years of life in its small rooms. The door wasn't even locked.
But this was very different
to what Monitor had first thought.
Some of the plants had died because they hadn't been watered. This wasn't at all what he'd expected.
The house had probably been converted some years ago. It seemed to be the highest point in the village. It was warm in here, like a summer house.
He looked at the back of all the other houses on the hill. Some had had pieces built on, obviously to match this house. All the plants inside here had died too. The fireplace had been cleared. There were no blinds or curtains. There probably never had been. But there were some lamps and smart plywood light fittings. Monitor didn't examine anything closely.
He wanted to lean on something, so he went through to the kitchen where he could lean on the windowsill.
The view from this side of the house wasn't quite what he'd expected either. This part of the village was more industrial in nature than he'd thought.
Living on more than dreams in the summer.
A train with no windows.
A train with no windows. He wished he had his camera with him.
If you were trying to explain who Monitor was in your world, how would you describe him?
I would say that the reason I've got Monitor there is because if you had, say, some 20-year-old male character who has just looked normal, dressed normally, he wouldn't be so effective, because you'd have to explain why he was interested in these things. You know, why wasn't he trying to impress the girls next door? You know, why wasn't he trying to get a job? Why? And you'd have to do all that explanation about why he was interested in buildings and weird stuff. Whereas with Monitor, got helmet, looks weird, okay, straight in there. You know, it's easier to have him like that.
Monitor's a funny character because immediately he stands out in the strips. You wonder, like, why is there a character who has a helmet on that is obscures most of his face? And no one seems to be perplexed by it in the stories. Nobody mentions it. There's some reference to Monitor having come from somewhere else. There's a hint that he has a spaceship somewhere, which seems absurd and even kind of stupid in a way. You think, like, that's really, like, what, he's a spaceman? But it's so vague. This is what's wonderful about the Mauritania comics, is that just you get little bits of information, and that information is it's appealing, but it doesn't spoil the mystery in any way. It only just adds another layer of absurdity or complexity to the stories. He's also strangely passive, which I find kind of interesting for a protagonist, in that he doesn't really do anything. Things happen to him. He goes places. In one story, he inherits a house. Another one, he goes to visit a friend and gets kidnapped. These are all, they sound like they're plots, but they're not really plots at all. They're just sort of happenstance. The stories sort of unfold in a very slow, quiet way, where Monitor sort of just moves around in these spaces, which I find is an essential element of what Reynolds is always doing in his work, which is sort of teasing us with the experience of place and time rather than plot or story.
In and out of the sun.
In and out of the sun. The sunlight roars across the fields towards me. All those old hills. Where were you when we both were children? End.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the actual graphic qualities of your work, which are so distinctive and powerful. I think in the introduction I say something like, it's not just black and white, it's like black and white and black.
A lot of people have picked up on that, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
A part of the style comes from old films and Super 8 films, because I used to make Super 8 films, and I had my own projector, and I made a screen, and I read somewhere, if you paint the edge of the screen black, it'll enhance the contrast of your film. So I thought, I'll do that. And that idea kind of carried over into the comics. I thought, all right, it worked for the Super 8. I'll do a nice, thick black line around the comic panels as well. And for the artwork in the panels, it, again, in a way, came from films, more like old kind of newsreel films, black and white films, with those kind of crushed blacks where the black's gone too far. But it has a nice atmospheric feel to it. And I thought, oh, I can use that. And so that's where those two things came from, really. And I did it, and once I'd found it, it seemed successful, so I carried on with it.
The interesting thing about Chris Reynolds comics is that they look, I think most people often use the term woodcut when they refer to them. They look like the kind of thing you think woodcuts look like. But of course, if you really were to put the artwork next to woodcuts, it doesn't really look like woodcuts. It looks more like what they used to call a monoprint when I was in art school, where you would do a drawing on a piece of glass or something with a wet surface, and then you would print it down onto a piece of paper. And what would usually happen with the line quality is it would get blobby. So like everything would thicken up. His drawing quality has that feel to it. It's like they're very inky shapes, and like often lines blur together. You'll see like noses and eyes will start coming together as if they're, you know, almost drawn in precisely. Sometimes I think the drawing in the books reminds me of when you look at something on a hazy summer day, where there's a quality of fog between you and the actual object. I think it's what feels fresh about it to me is that the work was produced quite a while ago. I mean, most of the stories in that book are at least 25, 30 years old. And yet, if I were to just pick that book up, I might think it was written this year.
We see each other.
We see each other.
A Monitor story in which some of Monitor's strange imaginings manifest themselves
on the physical plane. Rosa waits and waits. Monitor knows the place. He has visited this city before. Rosa rings her home and the office of Prime Services, the detective agency where she works, to see if he's arrived at either of those places.
But he hasn't. She gives up waiting and goes to see her friend who works in the coffee shop around the corner.
The Comet Cafe. Perhaps Monitor has been delayed on the motorway. He travels by coach. She complains to her friend. Rosa and Monitor had been due to book tickets for a summer coach holiday for Monitor and for her family.
Then her friend asks,
"Is Monitor your weird friend with the helmet with the M on the side of it?"
"Yes."
Rosa says yes, and her friend tells her,
"I think I saw Monitor earlier as I passed the coach station on the way to work."
Rosa goes to the phone to ring her home and Prime Services again.
But Monitor still isn't at either. Her husband Jeff is taking care of their son Jimmy and wants her to come home.
Rosa says she's coming.
"I'm coming home, but first I'm going to go to the coach station to see if there's any sign of Monitor there."
Rosa asks a coach official she knows if he saw Monitor.
"Hi, have you seen Monitor today?"
"He says he did. In fact, he even spoke with him. Spoke with him."
Monitor asked where the Country Trails office was.
He gives Rosa the same directions. "It's closed. Time is getting on. Country Trails.
At home, Jeff suggests that Monitor could have met some other friend and might be with them.
"You know what Monitor's like," he says.
Rosa is reassured, but still wonders why Monitor hasn't left a message for her, either here or at the office.
Jeff goes on.
"After all,"
he says, how much do we really know about Monitor? He lives a fantastic life. He seems to see goodness knows what from inside that helmet. He lives in another world. In the morning, Rosa goes to the office as usual.
But as the day wears on, she becomes worried about Monitor again. She asks Mr. Prime if she can have some time off to look for him.
"Mr. Prime, can I take some time off to go looking for Monitor?"
But Prime says she can't, as she's the only good operative he's got left since Mike Higson went to Canada.
There's a bit of tension in the office after that. Then, in the early afternoon, the tea and biscuits lady comes round. Rosa is about to try and improve the atmosphere by making small talk about the tea lady coming at the same time every day. But this gives her an idea. Rosa leaves the office before Mr. Prime can say anything and goes to see the coach that Monitor would have been on yesterday arrive today. She'll go where he went from the coach station. And see if she can work out what happened to him. The coach.
She speaks to the coach official again.
"Is this the bus Monitor arrived on yesterday?"
He says yes, this is the time he saw her friend.
Rosa thanks him, then leaves the coach station.
"Thank you, thanks."
She imagines she's walking in Monitor's footsteps. She keeps a lookout for any places or goings-on that might have attracted his attention yesterday. She tries to phone the office, but there's just a faint clicking on the line.
The Country Trails office isn't far away.
There's far too much interest in like having things spelled out. I'm perfectly fine watching a movie saying like, "I don't really know what's going on. Maybe I should have paid more attention," but it's like, okay, I'm rolling with it. It's fine. There's some, actually a lot of movies I'm like, I know too much. I wish they had dialed this down. I think I can see a lot of Edward Hopper in the work. The way the places are very charged sort of environments in the same way that Hopper's paintings are. They seem to be quiet, mundane scenes, and yet something is going on under the surface. Like obviously Edward Hopper's painting of the Nighthawks is just some people sitting down and having coffee, but there's a weird existential quality to it.
That night, Jeff tells Rosa that during the day, Monitor had remembered what had happened.
He'd gone to the Country Trails office and spoken to the father about the holiday. But as he asked, he'd seen something strange.
But as he asked, he'd seen something strange.
Something wrong with time.
Something wrong with time. Outside his helmet, everything seemed wrong.
He'd felt strange on the country trails coach, too.
As though he'd travelled further.
As though he'd travelled further than he should have done. Then he'd realised that country trails didn't lead anywhere. The father and son knew what he'd seen. They hit him and hid him away. But they knew people would come looking for him.
They were so angry that Monitor even thought that they were going to eat him.
My big book of fairy tales.
End.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
How you choose to convey information in a comic always has meaning, even if you may not recognize when you're doing it yourself what it means. I'm not sure Chris recognized by the way he presented dialogue or information that he was making the work more distant. The thing about cartooning is there's like, you know, when you, the word balloons are probably one of the most awkward and strange ideas to come up with for how to have people speaking to each other. The whole comics medium is just a mishmash of ideas that, you know, were not put together with any great thought. And some of them turned out to be quite elegant and others turned out to be rather awkward. The word balloon is literally like a strange, desperate choice that early cartoonists came up with to figure out a way to have people talking to each other without it being written underneath, he said, she said. I think initially they put a little like line from some words to someone's mouth and eventually put a circle around it. And eventually you've got these little balloons that people either like or they don't like. And cartoonists have been struggling with them for 100 years. But it's interesting when you do something like take the dialogue and put it into a box, which we call a narration box, you've actually removed it from the immediacy of people speaking to each other in the way that a word balloon does. It suddenly feels like it's more distant.
There are often these really sort of profound silences. Toward the end of the graphic novel, Mauritania, I feel like there are many pages even where they're just kind of silent and we're kind of left with what we're looking at and we kind of project what we want onto it.
I think that's something that might have actually come from Batman comics, because I think in about 1970, they were doing this thing about how they'd sometimes have silent panels. And I think they even mentioned it in the editorials, but they're quite dangerous to use because I think that often silent panels, they tempt the reader to just kind of flip through or silent and kind of miss a bit, you know.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is all comics are silent. There's no sound whatsoever. I mean, this is the interesting point, is that when you're thinking of a comic and you're thinking that other comics are noisy, you're just thinking that there's a lot of dialogue and there's a lot going on. The interesting thing about comics is they strangely do have a rhythm to them. When you read a comic book, you unconsciously recognize almost like someone's making a beat in a musical manner. Like Reynolds comics are almost all little panels. So it's just beat, 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 beat. As a cartoonist myself, when I'm composing a page, I'm often thinking about the rhythm of the page. And so you'll have like three small panels, beat, beat, beat. And then you'll have a long panel, which is like a sustained note. It slows things down. Reynolds' work is very interesting because he almost always just works with the staccato approach. And yet it doesn't feel like, you know, you're getting like a tremendous rhythm. It actually is very slow. It feels like a long sustained note, the comic itself. And the fact that he uses very little dialogue, of course, makes the work feel quieter. You didn't see a lot of quiet comics in the past for the simple reason that they were mostly commercial products and they just couldn't afford to allow people to use the space that way. That was one of the big changes that occurred in the comics medium in the 1970s and 80s when artists started to use it for the first time for artistic reasons, is you could make a story as long as you wanted. And when you could do that, you could start doing things like saying, Why would I show a character like getting up in the morning and then in the next panel show them at work when I could spend the entire, I could spend five pages showing them getting dressed and going through the experience. And then you can, you start thinking about what you can impart. And then you start thinking about these kind of qualities of like what the medium, how it works, how does it transmit feelings? And of course, silence is one of the things that it's actually can be quite hard to make a scene quiet. Chris's work is interesting because it, I don't think that he probably labored it. I think he was had a certain feeling he was trying to impart, and yet somehow that the comics themselves have a sustained, slow, quiet feel to them, even when the characters are talking to each other.
Soft return.
This is my story. The story of someone who lost everything and then found it again. It's about how I remember my dream. I was so embarrassed the day I was made redundant from my job. I could feel all the blood in my face as though it wasn't part of me that day. My family had broken up during the war when I'd said I wouldn't fight. I'd never thought a thing like that could drive people apart nowadays. We'd all been Christians. The army, which I subsequently joined, sent me to Mouth City, at the mouth of the Snail River. I drove the foot ferry boat across the river. They gave me that job because of my name, Christopher. It was my new life. It was cold here, and I had nothing, no time to myself even, except when the river was quiet or when I was sent up to the fuel station. There was only one passenger for the boat that day. I could see their shadow through the river fog. It was a woman. She looked quite rich, despite the war. I wondered who she was. I talked to her, as I sometimes did to people I ferried across the river.
You should be in the Navy, not the Army.
Uh-huh. I had heard it before. I had to be cautious that morning, a Monday, the day the tankers came in from Liverpool. I tried telling the woman how I lived, that I was a sensitive person, that I didn't like the male humour in the barracks. But I could see from the way she looked at me that here was another woman who thought I was weak. I sometimes thought of just turning the wheel and sailing out to sea. But perhaps the women were right. Perhaps I was weak. The day at work when they had come in and installed the new phone, I hadn't complained. They came in and bolted it to my desk. There was no question about it being there. I had thought that I was doing well. I could manage the extra work that came in through the new phone. I thought I was secure.
What are you thinking about?
I hadn't been alert to the river. The tank came very close. We were almost swamped. The tide had been on the turn. I didn't know which way we were heading now.
I'm thinking of Soft Return, this absolutely kind of hypnotic story, fairly, you know, four or five pages, and I think that's the one where the name Christopher comes up.
That's it, yeah. I've put myself in that one.
Okay. Could you talk? I mean, this really like knocked my socks off when I read it. I mean, do you feel comfortable talking about that? Like,
yeah,
why
yeah,
did you put
yeah,
yourself
sure.
into it? Yeah.
I was kind of interested in my name at the time, and I thought, I'll put it in, you know, put it in a story. And so that's where it came about, really. As I understand it, the name Christopher implies the bearer of Christ, and there's some chap, Christopher, who carried the infant Jesus across a river or something like that. And so that's where the idea of being a ferryman kind of comes from.
Out there, lost on the river, we weren't worried. We talked quite naturally. She told me her name, then began to speak about her children, then about her own childhood. I was a good sailor. I'd automatically pointed the boat in the right direction. I don't know how. If I'd been a worse sailor, a story might have happened to me out there on the river. I watched her walk to one of the big houses on that side of the river. Then she came out of the house again and walked down to one of the caravans on the beach. Then she came out of the caravan and lay down on the ground. I don't know why she did that. But later I found out the war had broken up her family too. It was time to take the boat back across the river. She wasn't my responsibility now she was off the boat. It was just one more example of the world getting smaller and emptier every day. But then I remembered something from my own childhood that I hadn't thought of for years. I had always wanted to be a captain of a boat. This was it. It had happened. This had been my dream.
That's it for episode 100 of The Organist. It was produced by Angela Shackle, and it featured the voices of Catherine Borel, Tomos Lewis, Teresa Morrow, Chris Reynolds, and Isabel Sutton. The Organist is produced by me and Ross Simonini. Our managing editor is Ben Bush, and our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge Weitzkopf. Our editorial fellow is Jonna McCone, and our intern is Lauren Francis. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White, and our technical directors are either Ray Garna, Paul Smith, or JC Swatek, depending on who you ask. We'll be back with a new episode in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.